KALW.
Being the first to declare an emergency will hopefully trickle down to the other communities and hopefully to the country as a whole.
San Francisco became the first major American city to declare a public health emergency for monkeypox, evoking fears of a previous epidemic almost 40 years ago.
There are many lessons we can learn from the HIV epidemic. If we were swift in our response, it may not have spilled over into the general population.
We talked to an expert on infectious disease about reducing the spread of monkeypox in the Bay Area. Then we revisit the history behind the United Farm Workers, the rise of the union founded by Cesar Chavez, and its fall, as one historian describes it.
This organization has to make the pivot from being a movement to being a union.
That's coming up. I'm Suni Khalid, in for Hana Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Monday, Governor Gavin Newsom declared a public health emergency in California over the monkeypox epidemic. Last week, San Francisco became the first major U.S. city to do so. I spoke with Dr. Peter Chin Hong, an infectious disease expert at UCSF, about monkeypox and what can be done to reduce its spread in the Bay Area. Okay, we spoke earlier about the COVID subvariants. We also spoke about monkeypox, but since the time that we talked initially, San Francisco and New York have both declared public health emergencies because of monkeypox. Number one, were you surprised? And number two, what does this mean for the general public?
I was not surprised about this declaration, particularly in San Francisco. I was delighted. I felt to be proud resident of San Francisco because they've always been at the forefront. And the reason why is because this is a future forward look. It means a lot, both symbolically as to what we need to control this outbreak right now before it spills over to the general population. Secondly, and more importantly, it provides resources to be able to do that. We don't have enough resources. We can't dip into the COVID emergency funds. So we need that to do this.
What does this mean for the general public? Because we had spoken before, you said that 98% of those who had gotten infected with monkeypox here in San Francisco were either gay or bisexual men. What does it mean for that community? And what does it mean for the larger community?
So first, for the gay and bisexual men and the LGBTQ community, it is really an incredible step because it means that there'll be better infrastructure to administer vaccines. There'll be a more well-oiled machinery to coordinate testing and treatment, which is very clunky right now. And I think trying to be laser focused on that population is very appropriate right now because that's where the disease is. For the general population, if things stay quiet, that will be a success of this declaration because you don't want it to spill over into the general population. You want to keep things as quiet as possible. And you know if a prevention or a public health intervention works when nothing happens. So if nothing happens in the general population, that will be a success.
What could we see? I mean, what will we see on the ground, for example, if I became infected with monkeypox? What difference would we see with the declaration of a public health emergency?
So I think on the ground, if somebody gets infected right now and has disease, I think with mobilization of resources, what you'll see is several things happen much more quickly and in more coordinated approach, including something as like, should I get treated? Who's going to see me to evaluate and test it and confirm it's monkeypox? Right now, it's being burdened in a few sites. It will be more distributed around the city. And more importantly, something that's been sort of like not hitting the news as much, what about contact tracing? All these people who I've been in touch with need to be contacted. They need to be tested. They need to be prioritized for vaccines. That requires a lot of person power.
What's the biggest challenge with the vaccines other than the fact that we don't have enough?
I think the biggest challenge is really getting people to come and even get the vaccine. Sure, we focus on the people who are proud members of the community openly, but there are a lot of people who are very discreet about it, who may not be out. And I worry about that population sort of falling in between the cracks. And that's where we need to have multiple sites, meeting people in different ways to give them protection, because protecting this community means that everyone in the population protected, because again, biologically, the virus doesn't really care who you are. And we've seen that in the last decades of monkeypox outbreaks throughout the world.
You've been involved with HIV AIDS research. You saw that at the beginning. You've seen our response with COVID-19. Do you see any parallels with what became the AIDS epidemic and what we're seeing, at least in the early stages of the monkeypox?
Yes, there are many lessons we can learn from HIV epidemic. The first is that we need to be swift in our response. If we were swift in our response to the HIV epidemic, it may not have spilled over into the general population, which is what happened. We need to study it. We've devoted so many resources to HIV to refine treatment and prevention, even something as we take for granted like PrEP. And then number three, I think I'm probably most worried about stigma. The scabs will go away from monkeypox, but the emotional scars will remain. If people hate, are violent towards people who are suspected of monkeypox or who are part of the population that's affecting now. The other day, somebody asked me for treatment because she hugged a gay man. There was no visible rash, but she's worried. And I'm worried about that spilling over into the general population and how people feel.
Okay, last question I have. With this accelerated response, what will we see in the short term as far as the spread of monkeypox here in the Bay Area nationally, and what will we see in the mid to long term?
So in the short term, there are many things we can't control, even in San Francisco. In the short term, we may see diversion of some local resources and hopefully the state resources that have been devoted to other emergencies, diverted to monkeypox. So that may result in smoother diagnosis and treatment. And of course, rollout of the vaccine. It requires infrastructure to have people organized to give appointments and so on. I think, however, the biggest benefit will not be immediately seen. Unfortunately, it will be in the domino effect that San Francisco will have in other communities. We were the first to do shelter in place during COVID. So being the first to declare an emergency in monkeypox in the United States will hopefully trickle down to the other communities and hopefully to the country as a whole, because we do need a coordinated approach and we can't do it on ourselves.
That was Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF speaking about steps being taken to arrest the spread of the monkeypox outbreak. Listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba. Last week, the nonprofit Amigos de Guadalupe, with help from the city of San Jose, finalized the purchase of Cesar Chavez's family home. The property has been an official landmark since 1994, and now it's going to be transformed into a community center to teach people about his legacy. Most people know of Chavez as a labor leader and civil rights activist who helped co-found the United Farm Workers in 1962. But since its height in the 1970s, the UFW has struggled to retain members. To better understand the challenges that today's farm workers face, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Miriam Powell spent hundreds of hours interviewing former members of the United Farm Workers Union. She wrote the book, The Union of Their Dreams, Power, Hope, and Struggle in Cesar Chavez's Farm Workers Movement. KALW's Eliza Veal spoke with Powell back in 2019.
When Miriam Powell first moved to California to work at the LA Times in 2000, she got curious about the dismal working conditions on farms. She started asking what had happened to the union famous for leading the farm worker movement in the 60s and 70s.
Everyone I spoke to who was really deeply involved with farm workers was like, the UFW doesn't do anything anymore for farm workers.
She found that the story of how that got to be was largely unknown, even to some of the family members of the people involved.
The kids of a lot of these people talked to me and said, like, thank you for doing this because my parents would never talk about what happened.
They knew about the rise of the UFW, but its fall was more mysterious, in part because, according to Powell, Cesar Chavez had become almost a religious figure. So to many people, his union was beyond criticism. But Powell wanted to give him his proper due, which meant an unflinching record of his life.
I actually became convinced by some historian friends that, you know, that nobody knew who he was. He'd been reduced to this really sort of one-dimensional character, and he's the face on the postage stamp and, you know, the name on the schools and the streets. But I ultimately decided that it really detracted from his rightful place in history.
Like all California kids, I got the day off school on Cesar Chavez Day. Posters of the Great Boycott and Chavez's face were all over my classrooms. I learned how farm work hadn't been included in the national labor laws that gave other workers minimum wage, unemployment insurance, workers' comp, and everything else. I learned how people thought farm workers couldn't be unionized because they didn't have citizenship, they didn't speak English, and how the UFW proved everyone wrong. But from its height to the present day, a lot has happened.
So this union that made its, you know, that achieved this kind of remarkable success for the poorest workers in the state by, you know, si se puede, by not accepting that they couldn't do things and by instilling in people this belief that collective action could accomplish things, begins to see itself as a victim.
That union has become the organization that was recently voted off one of its largest farms by workers. How? Powell puts the big turning point at 1975. Cesar Chavez had been leading the growing movement for a decade. They'd won the very first farm worker strikes and contracts. They'd involved the whole country in boycotts. They created protections for immigrants. And Chavez was the commander-in-chief.
He used to say that, you know, his favorite role was to be the nonviolent Viet Cong. And, you know, to do guerrilla warfare. And that was what he loved. And he loved picking those fights.
Civil disobedience, lawsuits, strikes.
All of that he loved.
Then, in 1975, they won what seemed like a big victory. The UFW successfully pushed for the creation of the Agricultural Labor Relations Board, like the industry's own version of the National Labor Relations Board, which farm workers had always been excluded from. The ALRB would legally recognize unions and settle disputes between employers and employees. Most significantly, it would suddenly make it much easier for farms to unionize.
It was huge. I mean, there's this huge pent-up demand.
But the problem, it changed everything about the role of Cesar Chavez's UFW.
So suddenly, this organization has to make the pivot from being a movement that is fighting all of these battles to being an organization that has a bureaucracy. And Cesar Chavez was really aware of this, and he had very mixed feelings from the start.
Because instead of commanding the union like a military, he'd have to delegate. Many of the UFW organizers on the ground knew they needed new structures, hopefully democratic ones, so the organization could grow and be able to run itself without constant command from the top. But when they tried to push for changes, they were seen as challenging Cesar Chavez's movement. A split in the leadership formed along this question.
Are we a movement or are we a union?
Are we authoritarian in structure or can we have a leadership structure that's more dispersed and responsive from the bottom up?
And Chavez was like casting around for this way to preserve the union as he wants it to be and as a movement. And that requires kind of getting rid of people who are going to challenge that vision or be a problem for him.
Literally just kicking people out, anyone that showed any defiance. And this is the part of the story that has been difficult for UFW supporters to digest. The former leaders that Powell interviewed say around this time, Chavez started to really change. He'd become a hero to so many people, and yet he wasn't open to letting the organization grow bigger than him.
The thing escalates, and then ultimately part of the getting rid of people involves this meeting that becomes known as the Monday Night Massacre in April of 1977.
In which several high-ranking members were kicked out of the organization in a single community-wide meeting.
That meeting was the sort of the first and the most dramatic of the public purges.
After that, the union kind of shriveled into itself instead of expanding and growing.
They stopped organizing, they stopped organizing, and I think everyone would say that.
Because the more you organize, meaning engage and train members to take on more responsibility, the more problems those members can potentially cause the leadership, with their ideas and sense of ownership. So Powell says Chavez made excuses not to organize.
He began to say, well, we can't organize. There's no point because it's a Republican administration, because this, because that. And so this union begins to see itself as a victim and begins to portray itself as a victim.
It's true that unions were under attack at this time. For example, a few years later, Reagan would fire over 11,000 government workers for striking, sending a chill through the labor movement. And it's true that Chavez's union wasn't the only one to begin shrinking. But the UFW is an example of the kinds of unions that fell the fastest. Instead of creating democratic structures to channel growing energy from the bottom, Chavez squashed it.
The union never was a democratic institution from the beginning, but it had he was able to maintain the sort of fiction that it was democratic for a long time. And then he began, that began to unravel. It begins to unravel because of the workers and because there is leadership that is rising up in the fields through the union, he sees it as a real threat.
Powell says in particular, there are leaders that rise out of a big strike, the Imperial Valley Lettuce Strike in 1979. And the farm workers organized and won that strike themselves and got some of the best contracts in UFW history. But when leaders of the strike tried to run to be on the board of the UFW as rank-and-file farm worker leaders rather than UFW staff hand-picked by Chavez, Chavez fires them. There's a whole lawsuit over it, but in the end, even though the insurgent leaders win it, the UFW community shunned them.
They're pariahs. No one will hire them. They've been drummed out. And so this generation of farm workers who really could and should have been the leadership of the union, is gone.
Without a big staff capable of organizing new farms and keeping existing farms organized, workers lost touch with the UFW, just like the workers on Garawan farming. This was worsened by a lot of other obstacles, legal changes that made it even harder to unionize new places, changes to the agriculture industry that shut down farms that had been UFW strongholds in the past. But in Powell's mind, there's another piece to the story, which is the union took farm workers for granted.
And it was like, here we are, we're here to save you, and, you should embrace us. If you're against us, you're either stupid or ignorant, because you couldn't possibly not support us for any other reason. Or you're bought by the grower. I mean, that's the usual thing. And so I think that arrogance, which is shared by some other unions at some points too, of sort of like, we're an obvious good and we don't have to tell you why, has really hurt them.
One of the reasons the story of the fall of the UFW is so unknown is people who support unions don't want to publicize their failures. Powell says in her reporting, she had to convince a lot of people to break a lifetime of silence.
Because they still viewed the UFW as the best hope for farm workers. So it was like, we don't believe in the course that it was taking, that the union was taking and that Chavez was taking it in, but we don't want to say anything because we still think that it is the best way to help farm workers.
But Powell says people may be right that the UFW is the best way to help farm workers, but not if we don't push it to be better. Not talking about the failures of unions That's giving up on them and the workers they exist for.
Miriam Powell is the author of The Union of Their Dreams, Power, Hope, and Struggle in Cesar Chavez's Farm Worker Movement. She spoke with KALW's Liza Veal in 2019. This is Cross Currents. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba. Now we'll hear a reading about a desperate mother's search for her son. It's another episode from KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Barbara Graham lives in West Marin. Her book, What Jonah Knew, came out on July 5th, 2022.
It's a psychological thriller about the unbreakable bond between mothers and sons, even when it seems that all is lost and the bond is severed beyond repair. Here's a key passage from early in the book. Helen Bird wasn't in the habit of breaking the law, but the heartless creep in the motel office left her no choice. She had to find her son. She had to see for herself if Henry had left something behind, some subtle trace of himself that no one else would notice, but would point her maternal compass in the right direction. Luckily, the window to the room where he'd stayed was open a crack, and she was able to jimmy it just enough to squeeze through. If the creep who refused to give her the key saw her and called the cops, so be it. Maybe Saratoga's finest would show more concern than the smug detective back home who tried to convince her that Henry's disappearance was voluntary. Helen knew better, didn't she?
That was Barbara Graham reading from What Jonah Knew.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can hear more readings at kalw.org. Now, before we go, let's listen to some new music from a local band. This is the newly released song, O Henry, by San Francisco's band, Almond Joy. The Cross Currents team includes Hanisha Harjani, Lucin Mendel, Raphael Cohen, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tentz, Shireen Adel, Lisa Morehouse, Shia Levitt, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet
is interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Suni Khalid.